Her body caught on a jagged piece of metal underneath until it came loose, and then I put my truck in reverse and ran her over again. I took a miniature baseball bat and beat her to death with it, slow and hard and sad. I forced her into a hole I dug and kicked dirt and stones on top of her and buried her alive. These dreams were not surreal. They took place in plain, ordinary light. They were the documentary films of my subconscious and felt as real to me as life. My truck was really my truck. Our front yard was our actual front yard. The miniature baseball bat sat in our closet among the umbrellas. I didn't wake from these dreams crying. I woke shrieking. Paul grabbed me and held me until I was quiet. He wetted a washcloth with cool water and put it over my face. But those wet washcloths couldn't wash the dreams of my mother away. Nothing did. Nothing would. Nothing could ever bring my mother back or make it okay that she was gone. Nothing would put me beside her the moment she died. It broke me up. It cut me off. It tumbled me end over end. It took me years to take my place among the 10,000 things again, to be the woman my mother raised, to remember how she said honey and picture her particular gaze. I would suffer. I would suffer. I would want things to be different than they were. The wanting was a wilderness, and I had to find my own way out of the woods. It took me 4 years, 7 months, and 3 days to do it. I didn't know where I was going until I got there. It was a place called the Bridge of the Gods. Chapter 2. Splitting. If I had to draw a map of those 4+ years to illustrate the time between the day of my mother's death and the day I began my hike on the Pacific Crest Trail, the map would be a confusion of lines in all directions, like a crackling 4th of July sparkler with Minnesota at its inevitable center. To Texas and back, to New York City and back, to New Mexico and Arizona and Nevada and California and Oregon and back, to Wyoming and back, to Portland, Oregon and back, to Portland and back again, and again. But those lines wouldn't tell the story. The map would illuminate all the places I ran to, but not all the ways I tried to stay. It wouldn't show you how in the months after my mother died, I attempted, and failed, to fill in for her in an effort to keep my family together, or how I'd struggled to save my marriage even while I was dooming it with my lies. It would only seem like that rough star, its every bright line shooting out. By the time I arrived in the town of Mojave, California, on the night before I began hiking the PCT, I'd shot out of Minnesota for the last time. I'd even told my mother that, not that she could hear. I'd sat in the flower bed in the woods on our land, where Eddie, Paul, my siblings, and I had mixed her ashes in with the dirt and laid a tombstone, and explained to her that I wasn't going to be around to tend her grave anymore, which meant that no one would. I finally had no choice but to leave her grave to go back to the weeds and blown down tree branches and fallen pine cones, to snow and whatever the ants and deer and black bears and ground wasps wanted to do with her. I lay down in the mother ash dirt among the crocuses and told her it was okay, that I'd surrendered, that since she died, everything had changed, things she couldn't have imagined and wouldn't have guessed. My words came out low and steadfast. I was so sad it felt as if someone were choking me, and yet it seemed my whole life depended on my getting those words out. She would always be my mother, I told her, but I had to go. She wasn't there for me in that flower bed anymore anyway, I explained. I'd put her somewhere else. The only place I could reach her. In me. The next day, I left Minnesota forever. I was going to hike the PCT. It was the first week of June. I drove to Portland in my 1979 Chevy Love pickup truck, loaded with a dozen boxes filled with dehydrated food and backpacking supplies. I'd spent the previous weeks compiling them, addressing each box to myself at places I'd never been. Stops along the PCT with evocative names like Echo Lake and Soda Springs, Burney Falls and Syed Valley. I left my truck and the boxes with my friend Lisa in Portland. She'd be mailing the boxes to me throughout the summer, and boarded a plane to Los Angeles, then caught a ride to Mojave with the brother of a friend. We pulled into town in the early evening, the sun dipping into the Tehachapi Mountains a dozen miles behind us to the west, mountains I'd be hiking the next day. The town of Mojave is at an altitude of nearly 2,800 feet, though it felt to me as if I were at the bottom of something instead, the signs for gas stations, restaurants, and motels rising higher than the highest tree. "You can stop here," I said to the man who'd driven me from L.A., gesturing to an old-style neon sign that said White's Motel, with the word Television blazing yellow above it and Vacancy in pink beneath. By the worn look of the building, I guessed it was the cheapest place in town. Perfect for me. "Thanks for the ride," I said, once we'd pulled into the lot.
"You're welcome," he said, and looked at me. "You sure you're okay?"
"Yes," I replied with false confidence. "I've traveled alone a lot." I got out with my backpack and two oversized plastic department store bags full of things. I'd meant to take everything from the bags and fit it into my backpack before leaving Portland, but I hadn't had the time. I'd brought the bags here instead. I'd get everything together in my room.
"Good luck," said the man.
I watched him drive away. The hot air tasted like dust, the dry wind whipping my hair into my eyes. The parking lot was a field of tiny white pebbles cemented into place. The motel, a long row of doors and windows shuttered by shabby curtains. I slung my backpack over my shoulders and gathered the bags. It seemed strange to have only these things. I felt suddenly exposed, less exuberant than I had thought I would. I'd spent the past 6 months imagining this moment. But now that it was here, now that I was only a dozen miles from the PCT itself, it seemed less vivid than it had in my imaginings, as if I were in a dream, my every thought liquid slow, propelled by will rather than instinct. "Go inside," I had to tell myself before I could move toward the motel office. "Ask for a room."
"It's $18,
said the old woman who stood behind the counter. With rude emphasis, she looked past me out the glass door through which I'd entered moments before. "Unless you've got a companion, it's more for two." "I don't have a companion," I said and blushed. It was only when I was telling the truth that I felt as if I were lying. "That guy was just dropping me off."
"It's $18 for now, then," she replied. "But if a companion joins you, you'll have to pay more."
"A companion won't be joining me," I said evenly. I pulled a $20 bill from the pocket of my shorts and slid it across the counter to her. She took my money and handed me $2 and a card to fill out with a pen attached to a bead chain. "I'm on foot, so I can't do the car section," I said, gesturing to the form. I smiled, but she didn't smile back. "Also, I don't really have an address. I'm traveling, so I..."
"Write down the address you'll be returning to," she said.
"See, that's the thing. I'm not sure where I'll live afterwards because..."
"Your folks, then," she barked. "Wherever home is."
"Okay," I said, and wrote Eddie's address. Though in truth, my connection to Eddie in the 4 years since my mother died had become so pained and distant, I couldn't rightly consider him my stepfather anymore. I had no home, even though the house we built still stood. Leif and Karen and I were inextricably bound as siblings, but we spoke and saw one another rarely, our lives profoundly different. Paul and I had finalized our divorce the month before, after a harrowing year-long separation. I had beloved friends, whom I sometimes referred to as family, but our commitments to each other were informal and intermittent, more familial in word than in deed. "Blood is thicker than water," my mother had always said when I was growing up, a sentiment I'd often disputed. But it turned out that it didn't matter whether she was right or wrong. They both flowed out of my cupped palms.
"Here you are," I said to the woman, sliding the form across the counter in her direction, though she didn't turn to me for several moments. She was watching a small television that sat on a table behind the counter. The evening news. Something about the O.J. Simpson trial. "Do you think he's guilty?" she asked, still looking at the TV. "It seems like it, but it's too soon to know, I guess. We don't have all the information yet." "Of course he did it," she shouted. When she finally gave me a key, I walked across the parking lot to a door at the far end of the building, unlocked it, and went inside, and set my things down and sat on the soft bed. I was in the Mojave Desert, but the room was strangely dank, smelling of wet carpet and Lysol. A vented white metal box in the corner roared to life, a swamp cooler that blew icy air for a few minutes and then turned itself off with a dramatic clatter that only exacerbated my sense of uneasy solitude. I thought about going out and finding myself a companion. It was such an easy thing to do. The previous years had been a veritable feast of one and two and three night stands. They seemed so ridiculous to me now, all that intimacy with people I didn't love. And yet still I ached for the simple sensation of a body pressed against mine, obliterating everything else. I stood up from the bed to shake off the longing, to stop my mind from its hungry whir. I could go to a bar. I could let a man buy me a drink. We could be back here in a flash. Just behind that longing was the urge to call Paul. He was my ex-husband now, but he was still my best friend. As much as I'd pulled away from him in the years after my mother's death, I'd also leaned hard into him. In the midst of my mostly silent agonizing over our marriage, we'd had good times, been in oddly real ways a happy couple. The vented metal box in the corner turned itself on again, and I went to stand before it, letting the frigid air blow against my bare legs. I was dressed in the clothes I'd been wearing since I'd left Portland the night before. Every last thing, brand new. It was my hiking outfit, and in it I felt a bit foreign, like someone I hadn't yet become. Wool socks beneath a pair of leather hiking boots with metal fasts, navy blue shorts with important-looking pockets that closed with Velcro tabs, underwear made of a special quick-dry fabric, and a plain white t-shirt over a sports bra. They were among the many things I'd spent the winter and spring saving up my money to buy, working as many shifts as I could get at the restaurant where I waited tables. When I'd purchased them, they hadn't felt foreign to me. In spite of my recent forays into edgy urban life, I was easily someone who could be described as outdoorsy. I had, after all, spent my teen years roughing it in the Minnesota Northwoods. My family vacations had always involved some form of camping, and so had the trips I'd taken with Paul, or alone, or with friends. I'd slept in the back of my truck, camped out in parks and national forests more times than I could count. But now, here, having only these clothes at hand, I felt suddenly like a fraud. In the 6 months since I'd decided to hike the PCT, I'd had at least a dozen conversations in which I explained why this trip was a good idea and how well-suited I was to the challenge. But now, alone in my room at White's Motel, I knew there was no denying the fact that I was on shaky ground. "Perhaps you should try a shorter trip first," Paul had suggested when I told him about my plan during one of our should-we-stay-together-or-get-divorced discussions several months before. "Why?" I'd asked with irritation. "Don't you think I can hack it?" "It isn't that," he said. "It's only that you've never gone backpacking as far as I know." "I've gone backpacking," I'd said indignantly. Though he was right, I hadn't. In spite of all the things I'd done that struck me as related to backpacking, I'd never actually walked into the wilderness with a backpack on and spent the night. Not even once. "I've never gone backpacking," I thought with a rueful hilarity now. I looked suddenly at my pack and the plastic bags I'd toted with me from Portland that held things I hadn't yet taken from their packaging. My backpack was forest green and trimmed with black. its body composed of three large compartments rimmed by fat pockets of mesh and nylon that sat on either side like big ears. It stood of its own volition, supported by the unique plastic shelf that jutted out along its bottom. That it stood like that, instead of slumping over onto its side as other packs did, provided me a small, strange comfort. I went to it and touched its top, as if I were caressing a child's head. A month ago, I'd been firmly advised to pack my backpack just as I would on my hike and take it on a trial run. I'd meant to do it before I left Minneapolis, and then I'd meant to do it once I got to Portland. But I hadn't. My trial run would be tomorrow, my first day on the trail. I reached into one of the plastic bags and pulled out an orange whistle, whose packaging proclaimed it to be the world's loudest. I ripped it open and held the whistle up by its yellow lanyard, then put it around my neck as if I were a coach. Was I supposed to hike wearing it like this? It seemed silly, but I didn't know. Like so much else when I'd purchased the world's loudest whistle, I hadn't thought it all the way through. I took it off and tied it to the frame of my pack so it would dangle over my shoulder when I hiked. There, it would be easy to reach should I need it. Would I need it? I wondered meekly, bleakly, flopping down on the bed. It was well past dinner time, but I was too anxious to feel hungry. My aloneness and uncomfortable funk that filled my gut. "You finally got what you wanted," Paul said, when we bade each other goodbye in Minneapolis 10 days before. "What's that?" I'd asked. "To be alone," he replied and smiled, though I could only nod uncertainly. It had been what I wanted, though alone wasn't quite it. What I had to have when it came to love was beyond explanation, it seemed. The end of my marriage was a great unraveling that began with a letter that arrived a week after my mother's death, though its beginnings went back further than that. The letter wasn't for me. It was for Paul. Fresh as my grief was, I still dashed excitedly into our bedroom and handed it to him when I saw the return address. It was from the New School in New York City. In another lifetime, only 3 months before, in the days before I learned my mother had cancer, I'd helped him apply to a PhD program in political philosophy. Back in mid-January, the idea of living in New York City had seemed like the most exciting thing in the world. But now, in late March, as he ripped the letter open and exclaimed that he'd been accepted, as I embraced him and in every way seemed to be celebrating this good news, I felt myself splitting in two. There was the woman I was before my mom died, and the one I was now. My old life sitting on the surface of me like a bruise. The real me was beneath that, pulsing under all the things I used to think I knew. How I'd finish my BA in June, and a couple of months later, off we'd go. How we'd rent an apartment in the East Village or Park Slope, places I'd only imagined and read about. How I'd wear funky ponchos with adorable knitted hats and cool boots while becoming a writer in the same romantic, down-and-out way that so many of my literary heroes and heroines had. All of that was impossible now, regardless of what the letter said. My mom was dead. My mom was dead. My mom was dead. Everything I ever imagined about myself had disappeared into the crack of her last breath. I couldn't leave Minnesota. My family needed me. Who would help Leif finish growing up? Who would be there for Eddie in his loneliness? Who would make Thanksgiving dinner and carry on our family traditions? Someone had to keep what remained of our family together, and that someone had to be me. I owed at least that much to my mother. "You should go without me," I said to Paul as he held the letter. And I said it again and again as we talked throughout the next weeks, my conviction growing by the day. Part of me was terrified by the idea of him leaving me. Another part of me desperately hoped he would. If he left, the door of our marriage would swing shut without my having to kick it. I would be free, and nothing would be my fault. I loved him, but I'd been impetuous and 19 when we'd wed, not remotely ready to commit myself to another person, no matter how dear he was. Though I'd had attractions to other men since shortly after we married, I'd kept them in check. But I couldn't do that anymore. My grief obliterated my ability to hold back. So much had been denied me, I reasoned. Why should I deny myself? My mom had been dead a week when I kissed another man. And another a week after that. I only made out with them and the others that followed, vowing not to cross a sexual line that held some meaning to me. But still, I knew I was wrong to cheat and lie. I felt trapped by my own inability to either leave Paul or stay true. So I waited for him to leave me, to go off to graduate school alone. Though, of course, he refused. He deferred his admission for a year and we stayed in Minnesota so I could be near my family. Though my nearness in the year that followed my mother's death accomplished little. It turned out I wasn't able to keep my family together. I wasn't my mom. It was only after her death that I realized who she was, the apparently magical force at the center of our family who'd kept us all invisibly spinning in the powerful orbit around her. Without her, Eddie slowly became a stranger. Leif and Karen and I drifted into our own lives. Hard as I fought for it to be otherwise, finally I had to admit it too. Without my mother, we weren't what we'd been. We were four people floating separately among the flotsam of our grief, connected by only the thinnest rope. I never did make that Thanksgiving dinner. By the time Thanksgiving rolled around, 8 months after my mom died, my family was something I spoke of in the past tense. So when Paul and I finally moved to New York City a year after we had originally intended to, I was happy to go. There I could have a fresh start. I would stop messing around with men. I would stop grieving so fiercely. I would stop raging over the family I used to have. I would be a writer who lived in New York City. I would walk around wearing cool boots and an adorable knitted hat. It didn't go that way. I was who I was, the same woman who pulsed beneath the bruise of her old life, only now I was somewhere else. During the day, I wrote stories. At night, I waited tables and made out with one of the two men I was simultaneously not crossing the line with. We lived in New York City only a month when Paul dropped out of graduate school, deciding he wanted to play guitar instead. 6 months later, we left altogether, returning briefly to Minnesota before departing on a months-long working road trip all across the West, making a wide circle that included the Grand Canyon and Death Valley, Big Sur and San Francisco. At trip's end, in late spring, we landed in Portland and found restaurant jobs, staying first with my friend Lisa in her tiny apartment, and then on a farm 10 miles outside the city, where, in exchange for looking after a goat and a cat and a covey of exotic game hens, we got to live rent-free for the summer. We pulled the futon from our truck and slept on it in the living room under a big wide window that looked out over a filbert orchard. We took long walks and picked berries and made love. I can do this, I thought. I can be Paul's wife. But again, I was wrong. I could only be who it seemed I had to be, only now more so. I didn't even remember the woman I was before my life had split in two. Living in that little farmhouse on the edge of Portland, a few months past the second anniversary of my mother's death, I wasn't worried about crossing the line anymore. When Paul accepted a job offer in Minneapolis that required him to return to Minnesota midway through our exotic hen-sitting gig, I stayed behind in Oregon and fucked the ex-boyfriend of the woman who owned the exotic hens. I fucked a cook at the restaurant where I had picked up a job waiting tables. I fucked a massage therapist who gave me a piece of banana cream pie and a free massage. All three of them over the span of 5 days. It seemed to me the way it must feel to people who cut themselves on purpose. Not pretty, but clean. Not good, but void of regret. I was trying to heal. Trying to get the bad out of my system so I could be good again. To cure me of myself. At summer's end, when I returned to Minneapolis to live with Paul, I believed I had. I thought I was different, better, done. And I was for a time, sailing faithfully through the autumn and into the new year. Then I had another affair. I knew I was at the end of a line. I couldn't bear myself any longer. I had to finally speak the words to Paul that would tear my life apart. Not that I didn't love him, but that I had to be alone, though I didn't know why. My mom had been dead 3 years. When I said all the things I had to say, we both fell onto the floor and sobbed. The next day, Paul moved out. Slowly, we told our friends that we were splitting up. We hoped we could work it out, we said. We were not necessarily going to get divorced. First, they were in disbelief. We'd seemed so happy, they all said. Next, they were mad. Not at us, but at me. One of my dearest friends took the photograph of me she kept in a frame, ripped it in half, and mailed it to me. Another made out with Paul. When I was hurt and jealous about this, I was told by another friend that this was exactly what I deserved, a taste of my own medicine. I couldn't rightfully disagree, but still my heart was broken. I lay alone on our futon, feeling myself almost levitate from pain. 3 months into our separation, we were still in a torturous limbo. I wanted neither to get back together with Paul, nor to get divorced. I wanted to be two people so I could do both. Paul was dating a smattering of women, but I was suddenly celibate. Now that I'd smashed up my marriage over sex, sex was the furthest thing from my mind. "You need to get the hell out of Minneapolis," said my friend Lisa during one of our late-night heartbreak conversations. "Come visit me in Portland," she said. Within the week, I quit my waitressing job, loaded up my truck, and drove west, traveling the same route I'd take exactly 1 year later on my way to hike the Pacific Crest Trail. By the time I reached Montana, I knew I'd done the right thing. The wide green land visible for miles outside my windshield, the sky going on even farther. The city of Portland flickered beyond, out of sight. It would be my luscious escape, if only for a brief time. There I'd leave my troubles behind, I thought. Instead, I only found more. Chapter 3. Hunching in a remotely upright position. When I woke the next morning in my room at White's Motel, I showered and stood naked in front of the mirror, watching myself solemnly brush my teeth. I tried to feel something like excitement, but came up only with a morose unease. Every now and then I could see myself, truly see myself, and a sentence would come to me thundering like a god into my head, and as I saw myself then in front of that tarnished mirror, what came was the woman with the hole in her heart. That was me. That was why I'd longed for a companion the night before. That was why I was here, naked in a motel with this preposterous idea of hiking alone for 3 months on the PCT. I set my toothbrush down, then leaned into the mirror and stared into my own eyes. I could feel myself disintegrating inside myself, like a past bloom flower in the wind. Every time I moved a muscle, another petal of me blew away. "Please," I thought. "Please." I went to the bed and looked at my hiking outfit. I'd laid it out carefully on the bed before I'd gotten into the shower, the way my mom had done for me when I was a child on the first day of school. When I put on my bra and t-shirt, the tiny scabs that still rimmed my new tattoo caught on the shirt sleeve, and I delicately picked at them. It was my only tattoo, a blue horse on my left deltoid. Paul had one to match. We'd had them done together in honor of our divorce, which had become final only the month before. We weren't married anymore, but the tattoos seemed proof to us of our everlasting bond. I wanted to call Paul even more desperately than I had the previous night, but I couldn't let myself. He knew me too well. He'd hear the sorrow and hesitation in my voice and discern that it was not only that I felt anxious about beginning on the PCT. He'd sensed that I had something to tell. I put my socks on and laced up my boots, went to the window, and pushed the curtain back. The sun was blinding against the white stones of the parking lot. There was a gas station across the way, a good place to hitch a ride to the PCT, I supposed. When I let go of the curtain, the room went dark again. I liked it that way, like a safe cocoon that I'd never have to leave, though I knew I was wrong. It was 9 in the morning and already hot outside. The vented white box in the corner came alive with its breezy roar. In spite of everything that implied I was going nowhere, I had some place to be. It was day 1 on the PCT. I opened the compartments of my pack and pulled everything out, tossing each item onto the bed. I lifted the plastic bags and emptied them, too, then stared at the pile of things. It was everything I had to carry for the next 3 months. There was a blue compression sack that held the clothes I wasn't already wearing, a pair of fleece pants, a long-sleeved thermal shirt, a thick fleece anorak with a hood, 2 pair of wool socks, and 2 pair of underwear, a thin pair of gloves, a sun hat, a fleece hat, and rain pants, and another sturdier sack called a dry bag, packed to the gills with all the food I'd need over the next 14 days, before I reached my first resupply stop at a place called Kennedy Meadows. There was a sleeping bag and a camp chair that could be unclipped to use as a sleeping pad, and a headlamp, like the kind miners wear, and 5 bungee cords. There was a water purifier, and a tiny collapsible stove, a tall aluminum canister of gas, and a little pink lighter. There was a small cooking pot nested inside a larger cooking pot, and utensils that folded in half, and a cheap pair of sports sandals I intended to wear in camp at the end of each day. There was a quick-dry pack towel, a thermometer keychain, a tarp, and an insulated plastic mug with a handle. There was a snake bite kit and a Swiss Army knife, a miniature pair of binoculars in a fake leather zip-up case, and a coil of fluorescent-colored rope, a compass I hadn't yet learned how to use, and a book that would teach me how to use the compass called Staying Found that I had intended to read on the plane to L.A. but hadn't. There was a first aid kit in a pristine red canvas case that snapped shut, and a roll of toilet paper in a Ziploc bag, and a stainless steel trowel that had its own black sheath that said, "You dig it," on the front. There was a small bag of toiletries and personal items I thought I'd need along the way, shampoo and conditioner, soap and lotion and deodorant, nail clippers and insect repellent and sunscreen, a hairbrush and a natural menstrual sponge, and a tube of waterproof sunblock lip balm. There was a flashlight and a metal candle lantern with a votive candle inside and an extra candle and a foldable saw, for what I did not know, and a green nylon bag with my tent inside. There were 2 32-ounce plastic water bottles and a dromedary bag capable of holding 2.6 gallons of water and a nylon fist that unfurled into a rain cover for my backpack and a Gore-Tex ball that opened up to become my raincoat. There were things I brought in case the other things I brought failed. Extra batteries, a box of waterproof matches, a Mylar blanket, and a bottle of iodine pills. There were 2 pens and 3 books in addition to Staying Found, The Pacific Crest Trail, Volume 1, California, the very guidebook that had set me off on this journey, written by a quartet of authors who spoke in one calm but stern voice about the rigors and rewards of the trail, William Faulkner's As I Lay Dying, and Adrian Rich's The Dream of a Common Language. There was an 8x11, 200-page hardback sketchbook that I used as a journal, and a Ziploc bag with my driver's license inside and a small wad of cash, a sheaf of postage stamps, and a tiny spiral notebook with the addresses of friends scrawled on a few pages. There was a full-size, professional-quality 35mm Minolta X700 camera with a separate attachable zoom lens and another separate attachable flash and a tiny collapsible tripod, all of which was packed inside a padded camera case the size of a football. Not that I was a photographer. I'd gone to an outdoor store in Minneapolis called REI about a dozen times over the previous months to purchase a good portion of these items. Seldom was this a straightforward affair. to buy even a water bottle without first thoroughly considering the latest water bottle technology was folly, I quickly learned. There were the pros and cons of various materials to take into account, not to mention the research that had been done regarding design. And this was only the smallest, least complex of the purchases I had to make. The rest of the gear I would need was ever more complex, I realized after consulting with the men and women of REI, who inquired, hopefully, if they could help me whenever they spotted me before displays of ultralight stoves or strolling among the tents. These employees ranged in age and manner and area of wilderness adventure proclivity, but what they had in common was that every last one of them could talk about gear with interest and nuance for a length of time that was so dumbfounding that I was ultimately bedazzled by it. They cared if my sleeping bag had snag-free zipper guards and a face muff that allowed the hood to be cinched snug without obstructing my breathing. They took pleasure in the fact that my water purifier had a pleated glass fiber element for increased surface area. And their knowledge had a way of rubbing off on me. By the time I made the decision about which backpack to purchase, a top-of-the-line Gregory hybrid external frame that claimed to have the balance and agility of an internal, I felt as if I'd become a backpacking expert. It was only as I stood gazing at that pile of meticulously chosen gear on the bed in my Mojave motel room that I knew with profound humility that I was not. I worked my way through the mountain of things, wedging and cramming and forcing them into every available space of my pack until nothing more could possibly fit. I had planned to use the bungee cords to attach my food bag, tent, tarp, clothing sack, and camp chair that doubled as a sleeping pad to the outside of my pack, in the places on the external frame meant for that purpose. But now it was apparent that there were other things that would have to go on the outside too. I pulled the bungee cords around all the things I'd planned to, and then looped a few extra things through them as well. The straps of my sandals and the camera case, and the handles of the insulated mug and the candle lantern. I clipped the metal trowel in its you-dig-it sheath to my backpack's belt and attached the keychain that was a thermometer to one of my pack zippers. When I was done, I sat on the floor, sweaty from my exertions, and stared peaceably at my pack. And then I remembered one last thing. Water. I'd chosen to begin my hike where I had simply because from there I estimated it would take me about 100 days to walk to Ashland, Oregon, the place I'd originally planned to end my hike because I'd heard good things about the town and thought I might like to stay there to live. Months ago, I'd traced my finger southward down the map, adding up the miles and the days, and stopped at Tehachapi Pass, where the PCT crosses Highway 58 in the northwest corner of the Mojave Desert, not far from the town of Mojave. What I hadn't realized until a couple of weeks before was that I was beginning my hike on one of the driest sections of the trail, a section where even the fastest, fittest, and most seasoned hikers couldn't always get from one water source to another each day. For me, it would be impossible. It would take me 2 days to reach the first water source, 17 miles into my hike, I guessed. So I would have to carry enough to get me through. I filled my 32-ounce bottles in the bathroom sink and put them in my pack's mesh side pockets. I dug out my dromedary bag from the place I'd crammed it in my pack's main compartment and filled up all 2.6 gallons of it. Water, I later learned, weighs 8.3 pounds a gallon. I don't know how much my pack weighed on that first day, but I do know the water alone was 24.5 pounds, and it was an unwieldy 24.5 pounds. The dromedary bag was like a giant, flattish water balloon, sloshing and buckling and slipping out of my hands and flipping itself onto the floor as I attempted to secure it to my pack. The bag was rimmed with webbing straps. With great effort, I wove the bungee cords through them, next the camera bag and sandals and the insulated cup and candle lantern, until I grew so frustrated that I pulled out the insulated cup and threw it across the room. Finally, when everything I was going to carry was in the place that I needed to carry it, a hush came over me. I was ready to begin. I put on my watch, looped my sunglasses around my neck by their pink neoprene holder, donned my hat, and looked at my pack. It was at once enormous and compact, mildly adorable and intimidatingly self-contained. It had an animate quality. In its company, I didn't feel entirely alone. Standing, it came up to my waist. I gripped it and bent to lift it. It wouldn't budge. I squatted and grasped its frame more robustly and tried to lift it again. Again, it did not move. Not even an inch. I tried to lift it with both hands, with my legs braced beneath me, while attempting to wrap it in a bear hug, with all of my breath and my might and my will, with everything in me. And still, it would not come. It was exactly like attempting to lift a Volkswagen Beetle. It looked so cute, so ready to be lifted, and yet it was impossible to do. I sat down on the floor beside it and pondered my situation. How could I carry a backpack more than 1,000 miles over rugged mountains and waterless deserts if I couldn't even budget an inch in an air-conditioned motel room? The notion was preposterous, and yet I had to lift that pack. It hadn't occurred to me that I wouldn't be able to. I'd simply thought that if I added up all the things I needed in order to go backpacking, it would equal a weight that I could carry. The people at REI, it was true, had mentioned weight rather often in their soliloquies, but I hadn't paid much attention. It seemed there had been more important questions to consider, like whether a face muff allowed a hood to be cinched snug without obstructing my breathing. I thought about what I might take out of my pack, but each item struck me as either so obviously needed or so in case of emergency necessary that I didn't dare remove it. I would have to try to carry the pack as it was. I scooted over the carpet and situated myself on my rump right in front of my pack, wove my arms through the shoulder straps, and clipped the sternum strap across my chest. I took a deep breath and began rocking back and forth to gain momentum, until finally I hurled myself forward with everything in me and got myself onto my hands and knees. My backpack was no longer on the floor. It was officially attached to me. It still seemed like a Volkswagen Beetle, only now it seemed like a Volkswagen Beetle that was parked on my back. I stayed there for a few moments, trying to get my balance. Slowly, I worked my feet beneath me while simultaneously scaling the metal cooling unit with my hands until I was vertical enough that I could do a deadlift. The frame of the pack squeaked as I rose, it too straining from the tremendous weight. By the time I was standing, which is to say, hunching in a remotely upright position, I was holding the vented metal panel that I'd accidentally ripped loose from the cooling unit in my efforts. I couldn't even begin to reattach it. The place it needed to go was only inches out of my reach, but those inches were entirely out of the question. I propped the panel against the wall, buckled my hip belt, and staggered and swayed around the room, my center of gravity pulled in any direction I so much as leaned. The weight dug painfully into the tops of my shoulders, so I cinched my hip belt tighter and tighter still, trying to balance the burden, squeezing my middle so tightly that my flesh ballooned out on either side. My pack rose up like a mantle behind me, towering several inches above my head, and gripped me like a vise all the way down to my tailbone. It felt pretty awful, and yet perhaps this was how it felt to be a backpacker. I didn't know. I only knew that it was time to go, so I opened the door and stepped into the light. Part 2. Tracks. The words are purposes. The words are maps. Adrian Rich, Diving into the Wreck. Will you take me as I am, will you? Joni Mitchell, California. Chapter 4. The Pacific Crest Trail, Volume 1, California. I'd done a lot of dumb and dangerous things in my life, but soliciting a ride with a stranger was not yet one of them. Horrible things happened to hitchhikers, I knew, especially to women hitchhiking alone. They were raped and decapitated, tortured and left for dead. But as I made my way from White's Motel to the nearby gas station, I could not allow such thoughts to distract me. Unless I wanted to walk 12 miles along the broiling shoulder of the highway to reach the trail, I needed a ride. Plus, hitchhiking was simply what PCT hikers did on occasion. And I was a PCT hiker, right? Right? Right. The Pacific Crest Trail, Volume 1, California, had explained the process with its usual equanimity. On some occasions, the PCT would cross a road, and miles down that road would be the post office where one would have mailed the box of food or supplies needed on the next section of the trail. Hitchhiking was the only practical solution when it came to fetching those boxes and returning to the trail. I stood near the soda machines, up against the gas station building, watching people come and go, trying to work up the nerve to approach one of them, hoping I'd sense that I was safe from harm when I saw the right person. I watched old, desert-grizzled men in cowboy hats, and families whose cars were full already, and teenagers who pulled up with music blasting out their open windows. Nobody in particular looked like a murderer or rapist, but nobody in particular didn't look like one either. I bought a can of Coke and drank it with a casual air that belied the fact that I could not stand up properly because of the unbelievable weight on my back. Finally, I had to make a move. It was nearly 11, pitching steadily into the heat of a June day in the desert. A minivan with Colorado plates pulled up and two men got out. One man was about my age, the other looked to be in his 50s. I approached them and asked for a ride. They hesitated and glanced at each other, their expressions making it apparent that they were united in their silent search for a reason to say no. So I kept talking, explaining in quick bursts about the PCT. "Sure," the older one said finally with obvious reluctance. "Thank you," I trilled girlishly. When I hobbled toward the big door on the side of the van, the younger man rolled it open for me. I gazed inside, realizing suddenly that I had no idea how to get in. I couldn't even attempt to step up into it with my pack on. I'd have to take my pack off, and yet, how? If I undid the buckles that held the backpack straps around my waist and over my shoulders, there would be no way that I could keep it from falling so violently away from me that it might rip my arms off. "You need a hand?" the young man asked. "No, I've got it," I said in a falsely unruffled tone. The only thing I could think to do was turn my back to the van and squat to sit on the doorframe while clutching the edge of the sliding door, letting my pack rest on the floor behind me. It was bliss. I unclipped my pack straps and carefully extricated myself without tipping my pack over, and then turned to climb inside the van to sit beside it. The men were friendlier to me once we were on our way, driving west through an arid landscape of parched-looking bushes and pale mountains stretching off into the distance. They were a father and son from a suburb of Denver, on their way to a graduation ceremony in San Luis Obispo. Before long, a sign announcing Tehachapi Pass appeared, and the older man slowed the van and pulled to the side of the road. The younger man got out and slid the big door open for me. I'd hoped to put my pack on the same way I'd taken it off, aided by the height of the van's floor as I squatted in the doorway, but before I could step out, the man pulled out my pack and dropped it heavily in the gravelly dirt by the side of the road. It fell so hard I feared my dromedary bag would burst. I climbed out after it and pulled it back to standing position and dusted it off. "Are you sure you can lift that?" he asked. "'Cause I barely can." "Of course I can lift it," I said. He stood there, as if waiting for me to prove it. "Thanks for the ride," I said, wanting him to leave so he wouldn't be witness to my humiliating pack-donning routine. He nodded and slid the van's door shut. "Be safe out there." "I will," I said, and watched him get back in the van. I stood by the silent highway after they drove away, Small clouds of dust blew in swirling gusts beneath the glaring noon sun. I was at an elevation of nearly 3,800 feet, surrounded in all directions by beige, barren-looking mountains, dotted with clusters of sagebrush, Joshua trees, and waist-high chaparral. I was standing at the western edge of the Mojave Desert and at the southern foot of the Sierra Nevada, the vast mountain range that stretched north for more than 400 miles to Lassen Volcanic National Park, where it connected with the Cascade Range, which extended from Northern California all the way through Oregon and Washington and beyond the Canadian border. Those two mountain ranges would be my world for the next 3 months, their crest, my home. On a fence post beyond the ditch, I spied a palm-sized metal blaze that said, Pacific Crest Trail. I was here. I could begin at last. It occurred to me that now would be the perfect time to take a photograph, but to unpack the camera would entail such a series of gear and bungee cord removals that I didn't even want to attempt it. Plus, in order to get myself in the picture, I'd have to find something to prop the camera on so I could set its timer and get into place before it took the shot, and nothing around me looked too promising. Even the fence post that the PCT blaze was attached to seemed too desiccated and frail. Instead, I sat down in the dirt in front of my pack, the same way I'd done in the motel room, rested it onto my shoulders, and then hurled myself onto my hands and knees and did my deadlift to stand. Elated, nervous, hunching in a remotely upright position, I buckled and cinched my pack and staggered the first steps down the trail to a brown metal box that was tacked to another fence post. When I lifted the lid, I saw a notebook and pen inside. It was the trail register, which I'd read about in my guidebook. I wrote my name and the date and read the names and notes from the hikers who'd passed through in the weeks ahead of me, most of them men traveling in pairs, not one of them a woman alone. I lingered a bit longer, feeling a swell of emotion over the occasion, and then I realized there was nothing to do but go, so I did. The trail headed east, paralleling the highway for a while, dipping down into rocky washes and back up again. I'm hiking, I thought, and then, I am hiking on the Pacific Crest Trail. It was this very act of hiking that had been at the heart of my belief that such a trip was a reasonable endeavor. What is hiking but walking, after all? I can walk, I'd argued, when Paul had expressed his concern about my never actually having gone backpacking. I walked all the time. I walked for hours on end in my work as a waitress. I walked around the cities I lived in and visited. I walked for pleasure and purpose. All of these things were true. But after about 15 minutes of walking on the PCT, it was clear that I had never walked into desert mountains in early June with a pack that weighed significantly more than half of what I did strapped onto my back. Which, it turns out, is not very much like walking at all, which in fact resembles walking less than it does hell. I began panting and sweating immediately, dust caking my boots and calves as the trail turned north and began to climb rather than undulate. Each step was a toil, as I ascended higher and higher still, interrupted only by the occasional short descent, which was not so much a break in the hell as it was a new kind of hell, because I had to brace myself against each step, lest gravity's pull cause me, with my tremendous, uncontrollable weight, to catapult forward and fall. I felt like the pack was not so much attached to me as me to it, like I was a building with limbs, unmoored from my foundation, careening through the wilderness. Within 40 minutes, the voice inside my head was screaming, "What have I gotten myself into?" I tried to ignore it, to hum as I hiked, though humming proved too difficult to do while also panting and moaning in agony, and trying to remain hunched in that remotely upright position, while also propelling myself forward when I felt like a building with legs. So then I tried to simply concentrate on what I heard, my feet thudding against the dry and rocky trail, the brittle leaves and branches of the low-lying bushes I passed clattering in the hot wind. But it could not be done. The clamor of what have I gotten myself into was a mighty shout. It could not be drowned out. The only possible distraction was my vigilant search for rattlesnakes. I expected one around every bend ready to strike. The landscape was made for them, it seemed. And also for mountain lions and wilderness-savvy serial killers. But I wasn't thinking of them. It was a deal I'd made with myself months before and the only thing that allowed me to hike alone. I knew that if I allowed fear to overtake me, my journey was doomed. Fear, to a great extent, is born of a story we tell ourselves, and so I chose to tell myself a different story from the one women are told. I decided I was safe. I was strong. I was brave. Nothing could vanquish me. Insisting on this story was a form of mind control, but for the most part it worked. Every time I heard a sound of unknown origin or felt something horrible cohering in my imagination, I pushed it away. I simply did not let myself become afraid. Fear begets fear. Power begets power. I willed myself to beget power. And it wasn't long before I actually wasn't afraid. I was working too hard to be afraid. I took one step and then another, moving along at barely more than a crawl. I hadn't thought that hiking the PCT would be easy. I'd known it would take some getting adjusted. But now that I was out here, I was less sure I would adjust. Hiking the PCT was different than I'd imagined. I was different than I'd imagined. I couldn't even remember what it was I'd imagined 6 months ago, back in December, when I'd first decided to do this. I'd been driving on a stretch of highway east of Sioux Falls, South Dakota, when the idea came to me. I'd driven to Sioux Falls from Minneapolis the day before with my friend Amy to retrieve my truck, which had been left there the week before when it broke down while a friend was borrowing it. By the time Amy and I arrived in Sioux Falls, my truck had been towed from the street. Now it was in a lot surrounded by a chain-link fence and buried in snow from the blizzard that had passed through a couple of days before. It had been for this blizzard that I'd gone to REI the previous day to purchase a shovel. As I waited in line to pay for it, I'd spotted a guidebook about something called the Pacific Crest Trail. I picked it up and studied its cover and read the back before returning it to its place on the shelf. Once Amy and I had cleared the snow away from my truck that day in Sioux Falls, I got inside and turned the key. I assumed I'd hear nothing but that dead clicking sound that automobiles make when they've got nothing left to give you, but it started right up. We could have driven back to Minneapolis then, but we decided to check into a motel for the night instead. We went out to a Mexican restaurant for an early dinner, elated with the unexpected ease of our journey. As we ate chips and salsa and drank margaritas, I got a funny feeling in my gut. "It's like I swallowed the chips whole," I told Amy, "like the edges are still intact and jabbing me inside." I felt full and tingly down low, like I'd never felt before. "Maybe I'm pregnant," I joked, and in the moment I said it, I realized I wasn't joking. "Are you?" asked Amy. "I could be," I said, suddenly terrified. I'd had sex a few weeks before with a man named Joe. I'd met him the previous summer in Portland when I'd gone there to visit Lisa and escape my troubles. I'd been there only a few days when he'd walked up to me in a bar and put his hand on my wrist. "Nice," he said, outlining the sharp edges of my tin bracelet with his fingers. He had neon punk rock hair cut close to the scalp and a garish tattoo that covered half his arm, though his face was in precise contradiction to those disguises, tenacious and tender, like a kitten wanting milk. He was 24 and I was 25. I hadn't slept with anyone since Paul and I had broken up 3 months before. That night we had sex on Joe's lumpy futon on the floor and barely slept, talking until the sun rose, mostly about him. He told me about his smart mother and his alcoholic father and the fancy and rigorous school where he'd earned his BA the year before. "Have you ever tried heroin?" he asked in the morning. I shook my head and laughed idly. "Should I?" I could have let it drop. Joe had only just started using it when he met me. It was something he did separate from me, with a